Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of the Activist Lawyer Podcast. I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Maeve Harding, University College Dublin, Sutherland School of Law, and Professor Aoife O'Donoghue, who joins us from Queen's University Law School. You're both very welcome today.
Thanks, Sarah. Delighted to be here.
Okay, well, it's great. I've been following you for some time in your work. We're going to talk about some specific examples of your work. But before we get on to that, I just want to provide listeners with a brief introduction about you both. So firstly, Aoife, Professor O'Donoghue works extensively on projects relating to utopia, feminism and international law and tyranny. In particular, taking a law and humanities perspective that incorporates history, literature and theory. Aoife was co-founder of the Northern Ireland Feminist Judgments Project and is co-director of the Feminist Constitutional Futures Project. Dr. Maeve Harding is Assistant Professor in Family and Child Law at UCD, and her research combines a critical feminist perspective with empirical, historical and doctrinal rigour to challenge legal regulation of family life. She takes a particular interest not only in law and gender, but in how family justice systems actually work. Her work has been widely cited and has significantly impacted policy and practice. So absolutely delighted to have you both here. So I was drawn in particular to a very important piece of your work that you've both been driving alongside a number of your colleagues, Professor Mairead Enright and Professor Fiona de Londras, and that is Doing Feminist Legal Work, DFLW. So before we get into the project itself, what is feminist legal work?
I should probably just say before we go into it that the Doing Feminist Legal Work Network is funded by the Irish Research Council under the new Foundation Shared Ireland Scheme. So we'd just like to acknowledge that funding in the creation of the network. What is feminist legal work? Deliberately within the network, we have chosen a very broad definition of doing, a very broad and inclusive definition of doing feminist work. And we do put it on all our best practice guides, either, so I've brought it here to make sure that we say the same thing that we're saying on the guides. Which is like, it's any form of action really that ensures that issues of gender are central in legal policy right making, legal education and public discussion. So it's a deliberately broad understanding of the kinds of work that's done and its impact upon the legal system and legal policy. Well, I suppose myself and Aoife have recently returned to this island from working in higher education establishments in England and Wales. And we felt that coming back, there perhaps wasn't the same kind of support and mainstream interest in feminist legal work. And that as part of the diaspora, there had been some wonderful feminist legal work being done. And the Northern/Ireland Feminist Judgment Project is an example of that. And also the Alternative Mother and Baby Homes report that was written a few years ago. And the sense was really that we wanted to bring people together who were already doing feminist legal work, even if sometimes they didn't call it feminist legal work, and bring together people who are interested in doing feminist legal work, and bring together a sense of community and support in doing this kind of stuff, and also a bit of a crack and a bit of a chat. Yeah. Isn't that another aspect of it that we really wanted to bring to the table?
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of to create those spaces where you can have those conversations in, because I think in both our experiences and working in big feminist projects, the space to actually just be in and not have to always explain what feminism is and always have to explain why you're doing feminism and always having to define it, but rather just to be in a space where everyone, you know, might have different versions that they do or interpretations, but that we're all collectively together. Because any of the projects that I've worked on, I think Maeve the same, that have been feminist in focus, have created lovely, supporting, sort of non-sort of confrontational events and networks, which not always, of course, I mean, it's not as much as I do utopias, it's not that it's utopia. Yeah. But in and I think we wanted to kind of replicate that and try to make it into something with a bit more permanence. Because we knew there was huge amounts of work and that there's always been the sort of activity around feminism and law across the island forever. Yeah. Right. So it's not sort of suggest anything that we're doing is new to what, you know, lawyers and activists have been doing, grassroots day-to-day life have been doing for forever really. But rather to kind of to create a bit of a structure around it so that people, you know, meet each other, share experiences, share knowledge, support, all those kinds of things. That sort of simply being in I think, either being part of the diaspora where you kind of have to build up yourself anyway, or else being in institutions where we both worked in institutions where doing feminism and law was long established and not really a question. Mm-hmm. And sort of being able to reestablish that back here was kind of important to us both.
And you've created this fantastic space that we'll go into detail in a little bit. But just for anybody listening, who might the project appeal to? You said it's people doing feminist legal work, and you've explained that. Does that include, obviously, practitioners as well as academics? And are those the people that you'd like to, you know, introduce to the work and hope that they become members?
Absolutely. Because I think oftentimes you kind of take inspiration from all the, even if you look at, say, the referendum next week in the Republic, the sort of collaborations that go on between people who practice law or do law in their jobs, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's in civil societies, NGOs, grassroots organizations, because those alliances have always been there, as well as sort of the legal academic environment. And I suppose amongst the academics, we're trying to encourage people who, you know, because it hasn't been a mainstream thing to do, might like to do it, but don't see themselves necessarily doing feminist research, but would maybe like to do feminist teaching, for instance, like, or, you know, feminist supervision, like that they'd like to sort of know about the kind of practical things, or, you know, if you're, how to build those alliances, you know, so people who'd like to sort of do that, just say like the mother and baby home rewrite report, they would like to do that, kind of, okay, here's a group I can go and join, and maybe learn how to do those things successfully and meet people who might be interested in the same topics as me. So we're very much, and I mean, it's based here on the island, but we're both are in the diaspora for long enough that we're also, you know, just generally interested in Ireland. Is we don't have like a strict membership criteria or anything. So, you know, you can be on the other side of the world and your research might touch upon Ireland and you'd like to join the network. Or you might be practicing the other side of the world and you're, you know, and you do things related or of interest that you think might be, or you're in a country where they're going through a lot of constitutional change, for instance, or family change, and you're interested. So we're not particularly restrictive in that sense either, I would say. So to sort of, you know, you have to be here and have to be present. Yeah. That's
it. Well, the website itself, which is dflw.ie, and we will share that with listeners, there are a huge range of resources there. And you've also developed some best practice guidance as well, which I think are extremely useful. Some member publications and feminist resources. I also had a good nose today, and I love the list of feminist podcasts, films, documentaries, and art. So you were saying there about trying to create this space where it feels quite welcoming as well. And I always think that when you talk about legal networks, it's quite dry and it's quite, you know, static. So this seems to be a little bit more interactive. Maeve, is that your goal around this? And how do you really shift from having that traditional networking stance to really make it a little bit more interactive and innovative?
I do serious academic work, but I also like some of these things to be fun. Right? Yeah. So one of the things that was very important to us, though, people wouldn't have to feel like they had read all the feminism, right, to be involved. They would have to have read all the very serious theoretical stuff that had been on there, that they'd be able to, that they have to niche themselves as a particular type of feminist. We didn't want that. We wanted a much broader approach to the idea of identifying as a feminist and doing feminist research. And also, like, in these other mediums, that's where a lot of the creative stuff is happening, really. Like, you talk about, like, some of the stuff is artworks, like the work by Julie Morrissey about positions gendered male in Bunratt Éireann. Some of it is podcasts, some of it is films. Yeah. And it's really, again, to sort of break away those structures of academic knowledge. Do you know what I mean? So if we're only picking certain journals, then that's a particular view of feminism. We want to have a broader one. We've done a lot of work on trying to make the events fun and non-hierarchical. And we also, it's tricky because people are busy as well. So you have to kind of have something that's going to be fun, that's going to talk about feminism, that's going to be approachable. Yeah. Because another thing that we realised is that, like, the longer you go on in your career, the easier it is to find people to ask to help you to do things, right? Mm-hmm. But that's harder when you're starting out, or harder when you're starting out in a new area. And we really wanted it to be, you know, not beginners with it, you know, like, it's just a sort of more approachable surrounding where you were doing an interesting activity that made you think about things, but you wouldn't have to feel that you had already a lot of knowledge to come into that space and start talking to people about how you might take your work further in a particular direction.
Sure, and I see that you're building upon those resources too, Aoife. We were saying about the latest publication, which is the best practice guidance on feminist PhD supervision. How are people reacting to that type of publication? I imagine it's quite novel and it's probably very useful by the sounds of it.
Yeah, actually the response to it has been phenomenal. Probably the biggest response we've had to any of them. And I mean, some through social media so far, but kind of a global response as well. Oh. You know, there's been people in Germany creating threads about it. People like the Australian New Zealand International Law Association had, you know, retweeted it and talked about it, which has been really lovely, because I do think that you know, PhD supervision is an area where, you know, it can be very lonely. It's a hard thing to do, and relationships can sometimes go awry. And I was very lucky in my PhD supervision, and I learned how to do it because I had a good PhD supervisor. But if you don't have a positive experience, it can be very difficult to know how to do it. And also then as a student, because we've got students to write, you know, current PhD students to write as well, like what they need from the process, what they would like. And they gave a range of different kind of ways and forms as well, which is really lovely and interesting. What I think is really nice about that one is that it's kind of a range of different expectations, like about flipping hierarchies or figuring out what all the support mechanisms in your university are, or how to respond when your supervisor, you know, one of them, Richard Bunn, his UCD, talks about how he wasn't planning on doing anything particularly gendered or feminist, but that his supervisor said, well, I think you should read this, this might be helpful, and that this opened him, or, you know, opened up a whole new set of knowledge that he could then draw upon. So it was lovely to have those, like, different people talking about different ways in which, as supervisors or as supervisees, and how sort of trying to not have that kind of master apprentice hierarchical thing going on, and sort of going as a relationship, working on a project together. But people have responded. I was amazed, because we only published it 3 days ago, and the response has been fantastic.
That's amazing. And does that may feed into, I see a lot throughout your work, you refer to feminist mentoring and peer support. Does that form part of that, or is that something separate? That seems to be something that you're focusing on.
Well, I suppose the best practice guide, like, it was very much a membership driven process and what we would like them about. So the first two we had sort of put into our base and we were planning to do, and then as the network gathered numbers and momentum, we asked what people wanted to do next, and the feminist PhD supervision was the next one on the list. But I think it really, like, it's really starting to show the kinds of informal collaborations that are coming together across the network, that we're, you know, getting people identifying these areas where support is needed to help people to work in a way that is inclusive and non-hierarchical, and then we're getting that support from collaboration across the network, which we're trying to make inclusive and non-hierarchical as well. And with the mentoring, it's about a year that the network has been set up, and the mentoring and informal peer support is a key goal of the network. And we've been establishing that so far by, you know, having a membership that can contact each other for things, by arranging events where people come into a space. We've discussed, so interspace and conform relationships kind of naturally in the space. We've also talked a fair bit about mentoring in some of our events, haven't we? Some of the difficulties that sometimes happen when people try to set up too structured a mentoring system, so that everybody has to do lots of training before anyone's allowed to talk to each other. That can sometimes be a barrier to effective mentoring as well.
And it's been nice to bring in people that mentored us as well. People who I would still look to, sort of peers and people who were sort of a few more years experience with me, and them being in the network and offering their mentoring and talking about how it changed over periods of time as well, has been, like, that's been really nice. That sort of kind of intergenerational makes it sound like it's a big time stand, but I think it is that kind of different kinds of experiences of mentoring as well, about, you know, and taking the positives that people have had and talking about the negatives and how we can help people when they get stuck in a negative situation, or when mentoring is only about career development. And it's just about that, and it's not about all the other things that are part of being, you know, like, feminist life more broadly, or just life more broadly.
And obviously, with both of you having, you know, professional expertise within your teaching and various issues that you teach on, you can bring that into the work and kind of use that to help develop some of the elements of this network. And Maeve, I was interested just as well in reading some of your work about teaching family law. And you mentioned that you try to decenter patriarchal legal structures. What do you mean by that, and how do you do that?
Yeah, well, I suppose that's a very highfalutin way of saying that I'm very interested in how the law restricts how people live their personal lives, and the kind of differential power dynamics that are created by laws, family structures, and that does sound rather highfalutin too. I worked in the UK for a long time, and you know, it was really about looking at how law doesn't really look at lived experiences of family life. So there's a lot of assumptions about the protective natures of family structures, such as marriage, state support of marriage. And then we look into how women and children are actually leading their lives and what their experiences are. And that's a very different viewpoint that hasn't historically been represented in the creation of that. And then if we take that further, you know, it's not just women and children, it's like different groups in society have very much not been listened to. So it's really about bringing out that whole, you know, law is more than the part of its rules, it's also a structure. And then returning to the South, where, as we know from the upcoming referendum, the marital family is absolutely central to family law, and everything is referential to it. And that's been a new challenge in sort of drawing together, like there's great stuff going on in the South in terms of empirical research, but drawing it together has been a bit tricky because it's probably not as well established. There's various reasons why it's harder to get to courts to do bigger empirical studies. But it's very important to me that we don't teach law as a neutral system to students, particularly when it has these effects. And sometimes what you get is something has been taught as, like, we call them like the big L subjects, big L law subjects for a long time. Students perceive it as being very neutral, and it's drawing out how it affects different groups in society very differently. And often it's because those groups haven't been listened to when the structures were designed. They weren't even, you know, like women and children's interests weren't really listened to at all in the 19th century when a lot of those structures were being designed that are part of the family law systems, both north and south. So with Deirdre McGowan, who's another member of the network, we actually created a new family law textbook for the South called Family Law in Context, where we place the family law rules within the context of the research that's out there about Irish families and how they're affected by law, and sometimes the historical context of how some of the rules apply, so particularly in relation to adoption and tracing. So it's really about decentering patriarchal legal structures. It's really about seeing their effects, like, on women and children, and not just kind of looking at them and looking at law as a closed system and assuming that they work well. Because there have historically been great assumptions that marriage is inherently protective, but then we've seen that it's not. Right? You know, it's great if it works well, but if it doesn't, then you might be in trouble. So it's like, again, looking at the histories that law has listened to and the histories that law has sort of ignored, right? Because particularly in the South, the early part of the century, you didn't make your marriage work out, it was your fault, right? It wasn't marriage's fault. And we're moving now to a more inclusive idea of different types of families, different types of situations, treating different people. And I think that's part of it. Like, listening to people's experiences of law helps to decenter these patriarchal structures that were constructed at a time when people do not listen to those experiences.
So interesting and so important as well, particularly in her current climate. I'm just wondering as well, I suppose we're talking about family law there, but what other issues are emerging? And obviously Britain is included within your network. So across Ireland and Britain, what issues, and I guess this is for both of you, are you coming across, and where maybe is your network focused on? Is there one particular, two, three particular areas within feminism and the law? Have you noticed anything, Aoife, or is there anything in particular that you're looking at with the network?
Well, actually, following one of our workshops where we focused on kind of how to do rapid legal responses, like how to do policy responses as a collective group, Ciara Fitzpatrick, who's Ulster, she's part of the network, brought a group together to look at the cost of living crisis in Northern Ireland. And of course, that's a huge issue in Britain and Ireland as well. And several different members of the network, you know. And what's important about the network is this wasn't myself and Nate, right? They drove themselves doing this. Excellent. We had nothing to do with it other than introduce. They all came to an event on a day. So that's ideally what we want, right? That's exactly the kind of scenario we want, where people meet, they build connections, they go, there's this thing, we need to respond. And care really has been, you know, the impact on children, the cost of, on access to education, especially if you have needs. And particularly in Northern Ireland, when I know the executive's obviously back up and running now, but in the period running up, and a lot of those issues are not resolved, are not being resolved. And I think that the looking at the figures coming out of London around obesity and child mortality, and they're quite alarming. So I think that's an area. I mean, that's not necessarily an area myself and Maeve would be specialists in, but certainly I think that's going to be increasingly, because it is, and it is the type of area where feminist methods of asking particular types of questions that normally don't get asked, sort of as Maeve was describing, works particularly well.
Yeah.
To figure out exactly what is happening on the ground. You know, why can't people access if these payments exist, or sort of the reality of if you're a carer, what that is really like on the ground. So I think that's particularly another one, which I think is probably going, that again is outside myself and Maeve's expertise, is around probably around technology and AI. And there's a few people in the network, like Katie Nolan and stuff, who work on that. And looking at, say, the way that that's particularly impacting on women, whether it's the way algorithms discriminate, particularly, it's like, you know, intersectional feminism is really important. Mm-hmm. But so from an Irish perspective, you know, how does an algorithm treat somebody who's a traveller? You know, like, how does that impact specifically on them? And again, so I think they're the kind of things that are emerging. And obviously, there's all the quotidian things have not gone away. Mm-hmm. Sexual violence, you know, the Irish government launched a new campaign there last week, which is really important and welcome. But I mean, the Northern Ireland is the second most dangerous place in Europe to live as a woman.
Yeah.
And that's a terrible indictment of the way.
Yeah.
You know, so none of, while there's new things, and of cost of living isn't new, but, you know, sort of the last 5 or 6 years has had a devastating impact on people.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like sexual violence, things like women's access to, so, you know, there's been more, just even within law, right, there's been more women studying law than men since the late 60s, early 70s. But if you look at the UK Supreme Court, where are they?
Yeah.
I mean, Queens is 50-50 at chair level. That is extremely unusual. It's a real outlier. The amount of black women who are senior professors in the UK and Ireland, there are none in law. There are none. And actually, law is pretty high representation overall in the UK, but it's a minuscule figure. So even within, you know, those things haven't changed. So all the sort of or it's the Irish Constitution, the Constitution of the United Kingdom, the Good Friday Agreement, and the way that it, you know, it divides Northern Ireland into two communities. Mm-hmm. But if you're a woman or LGBTQ or you're a traveller, yeah, right, you don't fit into those categories, so therefore you don't matter. So I think, you know, there's the new things, but all of those still,
perfect,
you know,
yeah,
all still need lots and lots of work.
There's so many emerging issues with the network. Of relevance to, it's kind of hard to to give an exhaustive list,
but
it's really about empowering our members to sort of get involved in these emerging issues as they come, and, you know, feel that they have support to raise the questions around gender and ask the questions in particular ways. And like, that kind of work is not without emotional toil, right? Like, so it's again giving a space in which, if you go and do this, and, you know, you feel like you've got people to talk to, kind of might not be doing it in that particular area, but they understand the kind of efforts that's involved in asking these kinds of questions of society and trying to push it forward in the different areas. So yeah, we deliberately are non-exhaustive on the things that we are relevant to, but there is a commonality to trying to push forward fairness and you know, intersectional feminism and identifying people's different experiences of things, and that is helpful to talk about within the network.
Brilliant. Just Aoife, one point that I was interested in is just the Feminist Constitutional Futures that you co-lead. That came out of the back of Brexit, did it?
It did to an extent, because I think Brexit got certain conversations started about the future of constitutionalism, of constitutions in the island. And where, I co-lead that with Catherine O'Rourke at Durham and Marie Dunright in Birmingham. And we're very particular, like, we're constitutional futures, so it's important to us that we're not we're not kind of getting stuck to the patriarchal system of what anything should look like, right? Mm-hmm. So the state as a structure, and I do international law, so the state as a structure, yeah. How you define what a state is, you know, it's this bounded, defined thing. And it's really important to us that we're like, well, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about having constitutional orders or order on the island that is feminist. So as a project, we've been running kind of for quite a few years now, but we're kind of looking at sort of not the necessarily the outcome, right? So not like, say, what's happening at the moment with the referendum in the Republic where you have, you know, wording that the government, but how do we empower women to see themselves as constitution writers? The example I use in my gender in the law class is, you know, because I try to get students to write constitutions or manifestos, and they're all kind of, oh, but I'm not qualified and I'm too young. And actually one of the people who drafted the Free State Constitution, he had failed his exams in law 10 years earlier. So I say to them, like, if some guy who failed his exam 10 years earlier was writing a constitution a decade later, there is no reason. You know, the people who write constitutions very often, sometimes they're not lawyers at all, no. And that's not a bad thing. I don't have to be a lawyer to write a constitution, but they have lots of different experiences. They come from lots of different, often they're very young, in fact, because a lot of the times you're writing a constitution that's after some big fundamental change, and big fundamental changes are often led by young people, right? They're not led, not always, but not, you know, in the main. So sort of getting people to think of themselves. So we've been working with Joanna McMinn, and she's been facilitating workshops with various different women's groups across the island to get them to think about what would their, this is kind of where my utopianism, like what would their feminist constitutional utopia look like? Like what would they ideally want? And then getting them sort of kind of getting past the barrier where they don't see themselves as capable of writing constitutions to actually write them, right? To write down what they would like, or not, doesn't have to be words as well. So one of the things we, Emma Campbell and Grace McMurray from the Array Collective designed a really lovely talk that actually Maeve used in UCD last week for another event. Kind of a ceremonial robe cloak that combines the West Cork cloak, which my great grandmother had, with sort of feminist text and patterns and representations. Because if you think, you know, if you think of a swearing in of president or the opening of parliament, you know, the people wear extraordinary outfits sometimes, or maybe they're just in very formal suits, but they're sitting on a really fancy chair, you know, and judges wearing robes and wigs and, you know, all these. So we thought, well, what would a feminist version of that look like? Mm. You know, what kind of ceremonies or artwork or, you know, even if you think of the way documents are presented. So that project is about, you know, getting women ready to have those kinds of constitutional discussions, so that it, you know, as discussions roll on, which they are at the moment, you know, they're there, they know they have a right to be there and to engage.
So good. I just about language, I suppose, as well. I was thinking back when I was reading through some of your materials to my time of working with third level institutions. It was part of an EU funded project with the National Women's Council that focused primarily on ending sexual violence and assault. Our model, when we presented it to universities and colleges across Ireland, we would say that it had adopted a feminist approach, and this is what we were doing when we were engaging with universities and colleges across Ireland. There was often a real kind of, you know, adverse reaction to us when we said that. And it was really getting down to the nuts and bolts of what that meant. But people initially were not really coming on board with that. It wasn't very well received. And I think it was off-putting to very many people. And I'm talking about maybe the hierarchy of the institutions themselves. But perhaps things are different now, and we've moved on from that. I'm not sure. That was some time ago. But adopting a feminist approach, you both referenced that throughout your work, and Aoife, you mentioned it in your teaching. What is the significance of that, and why is it something we should embrace as a whole rather than shy away from?
Yes, I think sometimes when you mention the word feminism associated things, there's kind of like a sharp intake of breath that happens at that point, you know what I mean? And why does it always have to be about the women, you know, like this kind of thing? And I think part of the network has been about reclaiming that word and not having to justify that word in so many institutional settings, you know. So I remember, like, there were some comments made about whether or not the network would be popular, and the network was much more popular than anyone had anticipated. You know, these kind of things, there's definitely a need there for this. And the idea is that, you know, the, a feminist way of looking at things, there are lots of different ways of looking at law, right? There's human rights approaches, and there's, you know, positivist approaches. They never really have to justify their approaches, right? But we always have to justify this feminist approach being an equally valid way of looking at things. And I suppose, what are we doing when we're adopting a feminist approach? Which, as I said, we deliberately kept it a very broad church within our network, but it's really about questioning power structures and questioning people's lived experiences of various things and listening to different parts of society about things. It's not really that radical when you think about it, but when we call it feminism, it can sometimes be challenging to people because, you know, it's seen as something other than, again, the big law, right? The big neutral law that doesn't have seemingly an ideological approach, even though we do know that there's nothing really neutral about law, right? It's a contested space, and it represents different interests, and there are different power dynamics within it. I think it's something that people do need to embrace, and we see, like, the sheer amount of positive social change that has been achieved by, you know, feminists or by women activists or by grassroots organizations who are trying to bring different perspectives into how our society works. And I think, you know, that is something to be embraced within a feminist network, and to give people those kinds of supports to be comfortable in claiming that word for themselves and not people in that space.
On another note, this episode will be part of our International Women's Day 2024. The theme this year for the UN's International Women's Day will be Invest in Women, Accelerate Progress. So, I mean, we're witnessing a genocide unfold in real time in Gaza. The images over the last couple of days and the reports from many, many organisations have really been startling. I feel like words like war crimes are just a euphemism now, because this is so stark and so something we've never really seen before at this level. But as we know, 2/3 of those who have been killed are women and children, and of course many children are now dying of starvation. I do see some, not very many, but some feminist groups who would traditionally mark International Women's Day are using this as an opportunity to focus on the extreme violence that's happening, and also to focus on the reproductive violence in particular that's obviously impacting girls and women in Gaza. So, and across the region, I might add. But as IWD 2024 goes ahead, I'm interested in hearing your views on Western feminism. We've seen this a lot recently in terms of the exclusivity around liberty and justice for Palestinian women and their children in their activism. Do you think they've been forgotten? I know, Aoife, it's something you've looked at previously.
Yeah, I mean, it is... I think since October, the horror that's been unfolding is incredible. And what happened with the food trucks in just the last few days, and the fact that people are back again today, queuing in the exact same place, knowing that people died in that, were murdered yesterday in that exact same place, is just shows the what these people are living with. That they are putting their lives on the line for the potential of possibly getting food, that is the position we're in. I think one of the most important things, and I think particularly because I work in international law, sort of my big field, and in that historically, white Western women have been really, really bad at actually not only hearing the voices of like Palestinian women, women in the Middle East, but actually listening to it. And Gina Heathcote and Lucia Kula talk about the need for silence sometimes, and the silence so that other voices can be heard. And that's extremely important, because there is amazing feminist activists, feminist writers, feminist lawyers coming out of and working in and always have been in that part of the world. But white Western women have historically often been involved in colonialism, right? So the person who was involved in drawing up a lot of those lines and that part of the world is a woman, and she often gets celebrated, and I'm definitely trying to remember her name, and now I can't. She was part of that colonial endeavour and part of drawing those lines, and where we sort of have, you know, this idea of, and if you, and I mean, Afghanistan is a different part of the world, but a lot of the narrative about Afghanistan and Western intervention was about saving those women, and we didn't save any of them. The ones who saved, they saved themselves,
yeah.
And saving brown women from brown men is not how. Is often what white Western feminism have gotten when talking globally, and not listening and not hearing. So I think in lots of ways it is about listening and hearing and finding from the people themselves. I know the journalists around the world have also signed a petition today about, because a lot of journalists, a lot of female journalists have been killed over the last few months, about, you know, those voices and hearing what they want us to do and where we can be helpful, rather than us planting our solutions,
yeah,
and saving them, you know, the sort of savior thing that can, and what happens then is that feminists end up embroiled in sort of military operations where we should have absolutely no place whatsoever. We end up being embroiled with solutions that we should be very far away from. But in the sort of saving narrative, it becomes useful. So as you were saying earlier, you know, it's like, oh, you know, it's off-putting. But if you want to justify using force or saving people, all of a sudden it's great to have the feminists and the women on board. It's a, you know, so I think it's really important to take that on board. And what I thought was particularly interesting, just from an international law, a feminist international law perspective, hearing the South Africa case against Israel at the ICJ, was the South African case really relied on feminism and gender, and talked about all the reproductive harm that's going on, and talked about, you know, women having cesarean sections without anaesthetics. And I'm not so sure that would have happened 10, 15 years ago.
Really?
But it would have been, and the South African team was also a very diverse team, which was wonderful to see, including an Irish woman.
Yeah.
But it was a diverse team, and they talked about the specific gendered harm. And I think, I mean, it's a small positive thing in a horrific scenario, but it, for me, it was the fact that they talked about it out loud in The Hague. They talked about cesarean sections out loud in The Hague, and that would not have happened 10, 15 years ago. Obviously, it doesn't help any of the women on the ground that that's happening, because these sort of international things happen up very high.
Yeah.
But that is now such an essential part of what, of how we see what's going on there. But I think actually following the lead of the people there, the women there, the feminists in particular there, the queer activists as well who are there, because I think in the West we like to think we do all those things, and that, yeah, you know, there's caricatures of what happens in those parts of the world, which are often completely untrue, especially when there's a pinkwashing that comes out of Israel sometimes, which intentionally represents the sort of backward view that they claim the Palestinians, the Jordanians, the Syrians, the Egyptians have, rather than like, us all having problems, we all right here. Not like we're, you know, we're all looking for the utopia. So for me, I think that's the most important thing, is the responses that those activists, those women, those lawyers, those writers want us, what do they want us to do, and actually listening to them and hearing them.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to kind of correlate between the two worlds, but that's really interesting as well that you've specified how the issues were clarified at an ICJ level. And obviously, as you say, it's not helping people on the ground, but that is significant in terms of progress. I guess just going back to your work and the network itself, how do people become involved, and how do people become a member, or can they loosely involve themselves with your work? How does any of our listeners contact or reach out to you if they can?
It's very easy to join, in the sense that you just go to our website and you send us an email, and then we put you on our mailing list, and we'll send you information about all the things that we're putting on, and then you're free to turn up whatever PC or so we're sort of getting, because it's the first year, we're going into like a new phase of the network, and we're thinking about better and more inclusive events going forward. So we might be having like an annual online event that people can come to if you can't actually get to one of the places that we decide to have events on in the middle of the day. And also sort of, you know, there's at least engagement with our members' activities as well that people can do. And, you know, that was great. We had Ethan mentioned we had an event in UCD last week called Bunrock Aloud, where we read the Irish Constitution from beginning to end. It was led by a poet student. Beginning to end. It took about 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
10 minutes less than it. We had some interludes, about the place of women in the Constitution, and one about the absence of the environment in the Constitution. So, you know, it was an event that was inspired by again a connection that was made at one of our events, and it was just a mainstream event, but bringing in those kind of feminist sensibilities, right? That we're fixating on bits of it, but has anyone appreciated what this whole document means? And why? So people were quite shocked. I mean, people called it hashtag law mass at the beginning because, you know, it was so religious and we were standing there and there were spells and things and there was a religiosity to the experience. And I think by the end, there was someone beside me who was listing all the things that they wanted to have referendums about. So it was getting quite exhausting by the end. But again, it was just, you know, this idea of, there's the core, like, doing feminist legal work run events that we are welcoming people to. You can sign up on the mailing list. And then there's also looking out for things that are run by our members, which are maybe, you know, something that people can turn up to as well. That might be a broader appeal. Yeah. But I think it's all a broader appeal.
Fantastic. And I saw you at a few events last year as well that they looked fantastic. They were in-person events as far as I think you'd four kind of key events. So they looked fantastic. So you'd probably replicate something similar and then, of course, do your online events as well.
Yeah, that's the plan. And sort of move them around because the initial funding was DCD and Queen's. But we've sort of got a few people already to volunteer to host some events. Sort of and move it around the island, you know, to try to, you know, particularly, you know, people out west, for instance, it can be difficult to get places. As we know from today, you know, the weather can play against you trying to get anywhere. And so trying to sort of, you know, move it around the island a bit. And also sort of, you know, if people wanted to tag events and use the mailing list to invite people or to share events they're doing and sort of to build up more, you know, they, like, for instance, if somebody wanted to do, you know, a policy report on something and they want to, you know, get a group together, they could use the network to contact people and say, oh, you know, I want to write a policy document on this. Is there anyone else interested who'd like to do it as well? And so it's sort of, we're kind of, as Maeve said, moving into that, kind of getting more people involved in running it. We're going to hopefully produce more best practice guides, because we have a pretty good template now going forward. Potentially set up a blog as well, maybe, so that we're kind of in the early stages of that. So sort of help, and sort of responding to, because we are hoping or trying to be anyway, a membership-led organisation. So what's needed? You know, what do the PhD students and the early career researchers who are in the group need? What do the activists, what would the practitioners like to have? You know, we're hoping this is will go on for years.
Yeah.
And that it'll grow and change and respond in the best ideal of feminism, where you don't become static and stuck into one way of doing things forever, but rather change and evolve and don't kind of get stuck into your traditions of doing things. That's the ideal. I mean, maybe in 10 years' time, but those still myself and Maeve running it like a journey, but you know, hopefully not.
Hopefully not. Well, I mean, the project in itself is incredibly exciting and incredibly innovative. The doing feminist legal work, there's so much on your website. I'd definitely ask listeners to have a look. Well, look, thank you both so much for giving up your time. I'm so fascinated to follow your work. You've done so much already in such a short space of time. I think it's incredibly useful. It's very much needed as well. And I look forward to following you going forward.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks for the invite. It was great to come and chat.
Yeah, it was great to talk about the network, Sarah. And thanks for having us on and accommodating all our snow-related difficulties in getting here.
We had a snow day, well, in Dublin. It's coming our way, I'd say, very soon. But thank you both for joining me via Zoom today. Thanks everyone for joining me today. If you like the show, please remember to share and leave a review if you have a moment. And you can also check out our website, www.activistlawyer.com, where you will see some blog articles written by our guests and contributors, as well as some fabulous Activist Lawyer merchandise.
This podcast was recorded in Granite Podcast Studio. Interested in starting up your own podcast, but don't know how? Granite Podcast Studio can help. Record your podcast in our state-of-the-art studio, which is based in the heart of Newry City. Our studio has cutting-edge and user-friendly technology and can seat up to four people. We also provide an editing service for our team, using your guidance and editing notes to provide you with a flawless finished product, leaving your listeners wanting more. For more information on how you can get started, visit www.granitepodcaststudio.com.